United States against Prince Bay. 12-1592, and we will hear from Mr. O'Connor.
May it please the Court, Nicholas O'Connor on behalf of the appellant Prince Bay. I'd like to focus on one issue, and that is that the government failed to meet its burden following the Santiago proffer. The admissions of the statement of the alleged co-conspirator, Vernell Hemphill, was conditionally admitted, and then the burden shifts to the government at that point to show by preponderance that a conspiracy existed. The government did not meet that burden. The government needed to show that a conspiracy existed, that the defendant and the declarant were members of the conspiracy, and that the statements that were made were in furtherance of that conspiracy. The non-hearsay evidence that they showed simply showed evidence of an agreement between the informant, Chubb, and the defendant, Mr. Bay.
Isn't there quite a bit of evidence, though, that Bay has a pre-existing drug business relationship with Hemphill, not Chubb, and that he is significant in brokering this deal, at least?
The
conspiracy doesn't have to be for lots of deals. It could be for one.
The evidence in the record shows that he has in the past had a buyer-seller relationship with Hemphill.
But in this case, it strikes me as much more than buyer-seller. Hemphill himself is testifying, so we have some non-hearsay evidence about Bay's role, right?
We do, but again, Hemphill's testimony cannot be used to show that Hemphill's testimony should be allowed. That hearsay testimony cannot be used.
No, that's not the way this works. I mean, what evidence is it that you're actually objecting to here? Who's testifying
about the testimony of Vernell Hemphill?
He shouldn't have been allowed to testify about his conversations with the defendant?
As to the conspiracy, it was made under a Santiago proffer.
Okay, I'm having trouble here.
What's
you're objecting
the
to the trial testimony of Hemphill?
Yes.
About what the defendant said to him?
Yes. He is discussing conversations that he had with the defendant in the record.
But that's not hearsay.
Yeah.
The defendant's own statements aren't hearsay.
Essentially, what's happened here is that the heart of the conspiracy and the agreement and things that he's saying he discussed or things that he's sort of saying occurred with Bay.
Hemphill. Yeah.
They're not corroborated by anything else.
They don't need to be. He can testify about that. It's not hearsay. There's no problem.
Because he was a co-conspirator.
It doesn't matter whether he's a co-conspirator or not. He can testify about what his in court about his own conversations with the defendant. The Santiago proffer and the co-conspirator exception would be, for example, if you had a police officer testifying about what Hemphill had said to him about what Bay had done.
He also testifies as to conversations that he had with things that other individuals said to him, that the supplier said to him, things like that, things that Bay said to him. Statements that Bay made related to statements, that, conversations that he had with Chubb.
I don't understand why Bay's statements are hearsay.
Statements that he had, that Bay had with Chubb, that went towards the existence of conspiracy.
But why? I mean, you're not answering a preliminary question, which is why testimony about what Bay said is hearsay. Bay's the defendant.
Testimony about what
Chubb said, maybe, you know, but I don't see that we're getting into what Chubb said. So, and I guess let me go back maybe to the failure, at least I haven't found a particular statement that was erroneously admitted, that you said, you know, on page X of the transcript, here's what Mr. Hemphill said, that was hearsay, it shouldn't have come in. I mean, you don't identify anything with particularity. So that's why, I guess, going back to what Judge Hamilton is saying, if your claim is that Mr. Hemphill shouldn't have testified at all at the trial, that's not sustainable. I mean, and maybe that's not what you're saying. But I don't know.
Again, we're looking at the agreement that was made and what he has to be testifying to, and the testimony that we're saying is hearsay is goes towards the agreement and the discussions that he says that Bay was having with Chubb to say, oh, you know, Chubb and Bay said that they're going to do X or Y, and he's putting forth statements saying that, yeah, this is what they said. You know, this is what happened. This is why we have an agreement.
So a lot of these seem like 801D2A admissions by a party opponent, right? So that strikes me quite a bit of the testimony you're complaining about definitely comes in under the rules of evidence. And then once that's in, there's a fair amount of evidence that the government can point to satisfy the what it promises in the Santiago proffer. You know, you look at the trial and you say, well, yes, you know, there was evidence of a conspiracy between Bay and Hemphill, and maybe not as good as between Bay and Chubb, but enough for Hemphill.
And again, we feel that the evidence isn't sufficient. We feel that the evidence goes to conversations between Bay and Hemphill, between Bay and Chubb, that continue to show that Chubb and Bay were involved in a buyer-seller relationship at best, where Chubb was initiating all the conversations about drugs, about money, and that Bay was simply working on one side of the transaction. He was only on Chubb's side of the transaction, not on Hemphill's side of the transaction. There was no incentive from Hemphill for Bay to make this transaction occur.
Wasn't Bay either asking for money from both parties or getting paid by both parties?
No. The evidence shows that at one point, after the initial conversations had started, he was offered by Chubb, who was working for the government, $1,000 to complete the transaction. There's nothing in the record to show that he was ever promised by anything by Hemphill.
I thought there was evidence that Hemphill gave $200 or $300 to the defendant.
Hemphill testified that he thought he gave about $200 to $300 to the defendant subsequent to the transaction, but there's no discussion that there was an agreement that he would get any money from Hemphill.
And Hemphill also testifies that if Bay hadn't vouched for Chubb, Hemphill wouldn't have sold the heroin to Chubb.
Good instincts. So.
Yeah, maybe not as good as he hoped, but
yeah.
Anyway, lots of evidence of cooperation, you know, that they're in this together, and maybe not the most overwhelming, but that's not the requirement.
And again, we think, you know, again, emphasizing that the cooperation, outside of being a conduit to deliver messages about price, about the type of drugs, about the place, the actual cooperation was between Chubb and Bay. It wasn't so much that, there was no authority. Bay didn't have any authority to make decisions. He wasn't moving it along with, let's do this, let's do that. He was simply a conduit for information because he was working on the buyer side of the transaction.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Crickbaum.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mark Crickbaum on behalf of the United States. There was more than sufficient evidence to conclude that the defendant and Vernell Hemphill conspired together, and therefore that any statements that were not admissions of the defendant, which of course would not be hearsay at all, that any statements admitted under the co-conspirator exception were properly admitted.
So what statements are we talking about?
I think it would be, it's a very limited group. I think the most obvious candidate is the statements that the defendant and Hemphill made to one another during the recording of the actual drug transaction itself.
That's not even arguably hearsay, though, right?
Well,
I'm not trying to make your argument for you, but I'm trying to find some co-conspirator hearsay that was admitted here.
The statements that Hemphill made during that meeting could arguably be hearsay. For example,
Hemphill makes a statement and Bay isn't part of it, then it would become important whether Hemphill was a co-conspirator, because the statement would be that of a co-conspirator.
A recording of Hemphill talking to Chubb?
Yeah,
we don't have that, do we?
Like that, yeah.
Or
we do.
Hemphill talking to Chubb about Bay's role in the transaction?
Hemphill talking to Chubb during the transaction itself.
Okay.
Arguably, some of those statements could be hearsay. If Hemphill says, I'm ready to sell you 100 grams of heroin, there could be an argument that that's hearsay.
That's an offer. That's not a...
I take your point that if there are any such statements, it is an extremely small group. And I guess the larger point, because the only challenge to those statements is that there was no conspiracy at all. So really this is both a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence on the conspiracy count as well as to the admission of the evidence. And I won't rehearse all of the evidence of the conspiracy, but it was certainly sufficient. As Judge Wood pointed out, the defendant, before Chubb ever approached the defendant about selling heroin, the defendant had had conversations with Hemphill in which Hemphill told the defendant, I am able to supply you with as much heroin as you need. When Chubb then asks about whether the defendant can get heroin, defendant goes to Hemphill, says Chubb wants to buy 100 grams of heroin, and Hemphill says, after the defendant vouches for Chubb, Hemphill says, I will sell him that heroin. There is a conspiracy there. There is certainly evidence of a conspiracy there. And, of course, the defendant then brings Chubb to the deal, introduces the two men, and accepts his fee from the supplier Hemphill, which Hemphill testified he paid this $200 or $300 to the defendant as a finder's fee for bringing Hemphill a heroin customer. That is more than enough evidence to show that these two men conspired to distribute heroin to Chubb. If there are no other questions, we ask the court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. O'Connor?
Just briefly, again, we feel that the majority of the evidence goes to show an agreement between Chubb and Bay. The crux of this conspiracy is based on that agreement, and we don't think that the record shows that Hemphill and Bay were involved in anything where they were on the same side of the transaction. They were acquainted with each other, but they were not on the same side of the transaction, and Bay had no authority from Hemphill to make any sort of changes to the deal. He was simply a conduit, asking, passing along information back and forth.
Of course, that's the nature of being a broker. You're a little bit on both sides. You bring the seller and the buyer together. That's why people use real estate agents when they're selling their houses, or whatever. And so I'm not sure that the same side of the transaction is a complete description of what's going on.
Well, there is a distinction in the cases that have found that, somebody was a broker. It's generally somebody who worked aggressively to get the deal done. Many times the person has offered to do more, be in larger roles, to deliver money or to, watch out for the police or to take some other role, outside of just being essentially a telephone between people, which in this case Bay was.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? We appreciate very much your help to the court and to your client. Thank you. And thank you as well to the government.